Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Slapcast. This is episode 12 of our coverage of the 2023-24 season. I'm your host, Gage, as usual, and on a weekend where both North London clubs fell from their unbeaten summits in very eventful fashion, Crystal Palace found a way to right the ship, and Man City showed us that, yes, they probably are going to win the Premier League again this season. Well, as everyone will be glad to know, mine isn't the only voice that will be regaling you all tonight. So too will the voice of Reese. Hello, Reese.
Hello.
Also, Ethan. Hello, Ethan.
Hello, Gage. How are you doing today?
I am mildly beleaguered after a long workday and a few more long workdays on the horizon, but I'm prepared to get things done on the show. So how about that? I'm eagerly anticipating a possible question of the day from Ethan, as most of you will have now noticed that Josh is not indeed back, as we promised that he might be this week. He's decided that he will not join us this week. Keep your eye out for him next week. Hopefully he will rejoin us. But in his stead, Ethan has come up with what is no doubt an exceptional question of the day.
Right. So we've been in contact with the man, but obviously with a busy month, he is taking a break. So all respect to him. This, you know, I feel like every time I ask a question, I'm asking something that's already been asked, but I can't remember. So I'm just going to ask it again. I have yet to eat anything today. And so this was the first thing on my mind was making dinner after the podcast. And what better thing to make than homemade wings? So I will be asking, what is your favorite wing sauce / dry rub?
It's got to be lemon pepper for me. I feel like I change up. I'll usually get like, you know, you get half your wings, one sauce, half your wings, the other sauce. I'm constantly changing my other sauce, but I consistently stick with lemon pepper for my other one. Both dry rub and the sauce, I like it all. Lemon pepper is just too good.
As someone who is something of a Buffalo Wild Wings fanatic, having it every Thursday for dinner, I've tried every single flavor on the menu except for the Blazin'. I have not yet ventured into the extreme.
Which is funny because I've tried that.
Yeah.
I know. I was there when you tried that, actually.
Oh, right.
And I still didn't try it. But so I have a pretty good sample size. I think at this exact moment, my answer is going to be honey barbecue, which I think is just such a well-palated flavor. You get notes of barbecue. You get the sweetness. There's a little bit of saltiness to go with it. Just works really well. I'm also loving the limited edition flavor at B-Dubs right now, the Bullet Bourbon Barbecue, which I really enjoy. It's kind of a weird taste, but I really enjoy it. And I like Bullet Bourbon and Bullet Rye Whiskey, so it's just kind of a match made in heaven.
Very good answers. The guys know me and my story with wings. I've had a bit of a revelation over the years. I've gone from, you know, getting no sauce at all to trying everything. So in my discovery, in my journey, I have been big fans of garlic parmesan. I know that's very tame compared to all the flavors, but it's always been reliable. I like the combination of parmesan and garlic. You know, since going to Buffalo Wild Wings, like Gage just put us on for BOGO wings, I have fallen in love with lemon pepper, like Reese has mentioned, and he's put me on, so I have him to thank for that. I've been making my own homemade wings just by buying some frozen wings from like Walmart or something, and then putting my own blends of sauces on it and tried everything. I like spicy garlic. I like, you know, I've had hot wings as well. Buffalo is really good, but my go-to is either I will always get garlic parmesan or a lemon pepper. Those are the foundational ones. As a funny story with some of the best wings I've ever had, we went to this like food truck yard where we went to college, and I was the last person to get my food, and they obviously had forgotten to ring the buzzer that I had. And so I went over there and, you know, I sorted it all out and got my wings, and I was the last person to eat. But those were the best wings I ever had in my life, so I can't be mad. So yeah, wings are the best.
I want to shout out, because we talked a lot about B-Dubs, and obviously I love B-Dubs for the BOGO. However, it's like a little treat every now and again is Wingstop. They have a Louisiana rub that Buffalo Wild Wings does not, and I love that flavor so much. The thing is, they're just way more expensive, so it's like if I'm really craving Louisiana rub, that's what I'll get Wingstop.
Yeah. And there's not really like a buy one, get one deal that a lot of wing places usually have sometimes, but it is very good. They did have a limited sauce not too long ago. I think, was it garlic parm and lemon pepper combined? Or like a lemon
that
garlic?
That was good.
That one was really good. I wish that one kind of stayed around, but.
There's actually a secret menu item that you can order at B-Dubs that combines those two flavors. It's called the Dirty Bird. So
I kind of want to try that.
Keep that in
mind.
I
like both
the
of
Dirty
those,
Bird.
So. I've been very hesitant to order special sauces items. after I ordered
Vampire Slayer incident.
Vampire Slayer, and she looked back at me and said, "What is that?" Or, like very confused. I felt very small at that moment, but. Yeah, it's a fun little question. I'm sure Josh would have had a good answer for that, but he's not here. So,
friend of the show and my former roommate Daniel orders Vampire Slayer every single time we go to Buffalo Wild Wings, and he is always met with, "What is that?" No one ever knows what it is, and we all have to be like, "No, seriously, like we're being serious. It's a real thing. Like it's even in your freaking system. You can go look and punch it in, and all this stuff." So, ridiculous stuff. It is great, but it's ridiculous that he orders it every single time, and then is surprised when no one knows what it is. So,
right.
Yep. Let's move on to the mystery segment of the week, where we're going to, last week we kind of dove a little bit into the spooky, we dove into the scary, some of the creepy moments that you've had. This week, we're diving into the weird, the strange, the bizarre. So Ethan's got another thing brewing for our mystery segment. I'll hand it over to him.
Right. So we were all enamored by all the names Reese dropped in his spooky moments. Go back and look if you can't remember, but I started thinking to myself when I was watching Palace this past weekend, and I was like, man, there have been a lot of weird names who have come through our ranks randomly. So I thought it'd be a fun time to kind of reminisce and think of all the weird players that have played for our respective clubs over the years. So you got your top five players. We'll start with our number five. So Gage, go first.
My number five is something of a surprise pick, probably, and I wanted to throw him in here just because I constantly forget that he played for Spurs. That is DeAndre Yedlin, who is the current teammate of Inter Miami legend Leo Messi. Absolute bizarro land stuff that he was at Spurs for a time, and then eventually was loaned out to Sunderland and then sold to Newcastle, I believe. So,
yeah,
crazy stuff.
People.
Before I give my number five, I'm just going to say something that I told Ethan and let you ponder on this as we go through. Because, typically with weird signings, you're thinking of players in the past. My number one ended up being a current Arsenal player. So I just want you to have that in your brain as we go through. Number five, someone I talked about in my spooky segment. I was surprised he was this low, to be honest, but I think, when the transfer went through, I actually thought it kind of made a bit of sense. And there were moments where I was okay with him on the team, and that's David Luiz. Got him for either on a free or practically for nothing, bags of Prem experience. He's decent playing from the back, obviously mistake prone. The main weird thing is this, as Gage likes to call it, this ancestral relationship that Arsenal and Chelsea have with sending each other players. Getting David Luiz was just really, really weird because he was a Chelsea player in my mind.
Right. So my number five is a really weird player who I only think got a couple of appearances for us, but we all thought he was going to be great. We, as in the Palace fans, because he scored on his debut against Man City. And that's Cenk Tosun, who was assisted by his former Everton teammate, James McCarthy, as well, who could have made an appearance on this list as well. But yeah, he only scored one goal in maybe the 10 or 12 appearances he made. And I think immediately went back to Everton and just got crowded out of the team. And I think, I want to say he plays for either a team in Germany or Turkey, one of the two. So yeah, he seems maybe like a good signing at the time, but, didn't pan out and ended up being really weird. So.
My number four, coincidentally enough, is actually a player who's played for all three of our clubs respectively, which I don't think there's too many examples of throughout history. And that is, of course, Emmanuel Adebayor, who spent a couple seasons at Spurs, scored quite a few goals actually in his time there. Completely bizarre because he went from Arsenal to Man City to Spurs and then went somewhere in Paraguay before signing a free agent contract with Crystal Palace. Did he ever score a goal for Palace or did he just make some appearances?
We'll get to that.
Oh, he's on the list, is he? So he, of course, was usurped by some bloke you might have heard about, Harry Kane. His spot in the team was absorbed by Harry Kane under Mauricio Pochettino, and then he was later sold on. So, yeah, bizarre stuff that Emmanuel Adebayor was in the team, but yeah.
So my number four is also a striker who is weird more in the sense of how quickly his decline was. I think there was only one game where I could say confidently he had a good game, and I think he had a hat trick, or he had maybe two goals, something like that. This is the player we signed for £20 million, and then 2 years later sold him to West Ham for £4 million, and that is Lucas Perez. He was just kind of, I mean, no one really knew about him, and I guess it is a gamble, but he was signed and practically put into the starting 11 and immediately dropped from the starting 11. I think for Giroud was starting over him at the time. So yeah, he really just never got a run on the side. And then he just kind of faded. And then we sold him to another London club for, you know, a tiny fraction of what we bought him for.
So this is the player who made me think of this whole segment. And it's funny because it's like not his, like I didn't go up to South London and steal his fucking pants, but I have bought the goalkeeper shorts a long time ago just because they were black and they'd be easy to wear like around the house or just working out. But in 2016, we signed Steve Mandanda. And, you know, at the time I was like, I don't know how we signed him just because he was really great. And he played all those years in France and was great. I think he was in the French national team as well. So there might have been some pull there by Kabay when he was in the team as well. But he only played 10 straight games and then immediately hit the bench. I don't even think he got injured. He just didn't play anymore. And then immediately left the season after that. So it's kind of just a weird signing in general. Well, that I wish kind of panned out, but, you know, it's whatever.
Fun fact about him, by the way, he's still playing. He's playing for Rennes in Ligue 1, and he has one appearance in the league this season.
Right. He's a French man by and by.
Oh, it's me. Sorry. I forgot it was me next. I was like, why is no one speaking? My number three player. Now, this is not so much of a weird player in terms of it was weird that Spurs signed him, but I've included him because you might not remember that he played for Spurs, and also a relation to a tweet that I have put out about him in the past. And that is, Reese knows who it is. This is Nasser Chadli, who actually scored 15 goals for Spurs in his 88 appearances in the Premier League. And he scored a few bangers too. He famously scored in the game against Crystal Palace where Dele Alli scored that over the top flick. Nasser Chadli also scored a 35-yard curler straight after that. So yeah, shout out to him for that. He then later on went on to have success at West Brom and various other places. Now, one of the reasons why I've decided to include him is because back in the 2018 World Cup, you may remember that Belgium were 2-0 down to Japan. And Roberto Martinez decided that he was going to bring on Nasser Chadli and Marouane Fellaini. And I tweeted, they're 2-0 down and need 3 goals to advance in this competition. And they've brought on Nasser Chadli and Marouane Fellaini. Lo and behold, Yann Vertonghen, Spurs legend, scores to make it 2-1. And then immediately after, Marouane Fellaini and Nasser Chadli both score to make it 3-2 to Belgium and to send them through to the World Cup semifinals. So just insane behavior by me to tweet something out and then immediately get proven wrong. So some absolutely crazy stuff by me. But yeah, that was why I felt the need to include him on the list.
Taking the bronze for me in third place, and quite possibly the worst straight swap deal of all time, is Henrik Mkhitaryan, who we got for Alexis Sanchez. That's terrible. Yeah, he was on number seven for a few years. Didn't really do anything. I think he, you know, he actually, you know what? He helped us sign to Aubameyang. So thanks for that, I guess. Yeah, that was basically all he did. Very strange signing. I have no memories of him in my mind playing for Arsenal besides Aubameyang's debut, in which I think Mkhitaryan got an assist. But maybe I'm making that up. Maybe it didn't even happen.
So y'all will remember this guy for his time at Cardiff. We signed him on loan the next season and made one sub appearance, surprisingly. Victor Camarasa.
Oh my God.
Had a decent run at Cardiff at the end of the season before they ended up actually getting relegated. But we signed him on loan, you know. I thought he was going to be great, you know, because we needed someone attack-minded in the midfield. Didn't get injured or anything, just didn't play, other than, you know, maybe a sub appearance in the like 85th minute or something. So I don't know what happened to where he didn't play at all, but yeah, that was very much a waste of time for him and for us.
I feel like you could have used him at that time too.
I think this was 18-19, if I'm not mistaken, but that was just so weird.
Would that have been Roy's first tenure or no?
I think it would have been maybe his second or third. So
tenure?
Or is second or third year in charge at Palace? I don't know.
Oh, I see. Taking the silver medal for me is someone that you definitely forgot played for Spurs and is currently now winning league titles at Celtic. He's been around a couple different clubs in the Premier League, the likes of Man City, West Ham, and Burnley, from whom Spurs signed him. That is Joe Hart, who spent a season on the Spurs bench as a backup. Did not play a single game in the Premier League, but played quite a few cup games. Apparently was a great presence around the dressing room, but just thought that was such... Spurs have had an absolute carousel of backup goalkeepers in the past decade or so, that Hugo Lloris was the number one. But Joe Hart probably takes the cake in terms of one that you definitely did not remember and was completely irrelevant during his time at the club. Joe Hart gets the silver for me.
It's funny because I had been doing a Scottish player career mode in this Premiership in Scotland, and he was playing in goal for Celtic, and I was like, what the heck? I didn't know he was still playing. So
he regularly starts too. Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. Postecoglou link there too, by the way. So.
Taking second place for me is a player it's not a surprise he's on the list. It might be a surprise he's not number one, and that's Denis Suarez. We've talked about him a bit in our spooky segment and in our worst transfer segment. But yeah, just a weird signing. We signed him in January. I believe he was our only signing in January, and then he played, I think, one game. He did not start. It was a substitute appearance, got injured, did not play again. I'm pretty sure that's how it went down. Maybe it was two or three games, but it was practically zero. And then he went back to wherever we got him from. I don't even remember. So very strange.
Barcelona.
Ah.
So this is someone that Gage mentioned earlier, but Emmanuel Adebayor was signed by Alan Pardew in the 2015-16 season, the winter window. Made his debut against Watford and scored. But proceeded not to score after that anymore, making only maybe 10 appearances. But, you know, it might have been good to have in the dressing room, but he absolutely contributed nothing in his time. It's funny that he all played kind of for our club. So he was a big name, and it probably made me really happy that he signed because of his goal scoring record, but it did not apply in that sense. But I will say the one thing that I will never forget about him is the amount of times he brought up his little friend on social media. And so yeah, he just had this guy with him all the time in all his pictures, and I don't remember his name, but he was wearing a Palace jersey that was like a million sizes too big for him and just looked like a dress. So you know, he brought me some good memories with that, I guess.
And the gold medal spot for me in terms of weirdest player, I don't even know how to explain how terrible this guy was in our midfield. What's even weirder about it is what he did after leaving Spurs that makes it completely bizarre. I'm talking about Benjamin Stambouli, who was absolutely dreadful in the midfield under Pochettino. Absolute disaster signing from Montpellier, of all places. But what's extremely bizarre about it is after his first 10 or so appearances for the club in the first couple months that he was there, Pochettino decided that he was crap, didn't want to use him anymore. He subsequently earned a move to PSG, where he started at center back for an entire season. So make that one add up. It also happened to be the 1 year in the last however many that PSG did not win Liga. That was the year that you might remember Kylian Mbappe's Monaco beat PSG to the title. So, yeah, strange one for Stambouli to come in. Strange one for him to go out to PSG after being crap all season and then changing positions and starting for one of the biggest clubs in Europe. So complete and utter bizarro land on that one.
All right,
at my number one, I'm sure you're all eagerly awaiting who this mystery player is that still plays for the club. I believe he has one appearance this season, albeit I think in a cup competition. And that is Cedric Suarez.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
What a random signing he was. I think he scored a screamer on his debut, randomly.
Wasn't it to make it like 5-0 too or something like that?
Yeah, it was like so random. There's been a few times he's been pretty bad. There's been even fewer times that I've thought, man, this guy's good. I don't really understand the thought process there. And obviously, you know, in a current side where we are severely lacking in right back depth, he still cannot buy a game. So I think that just says everything you need to know. Very strange signing. Oh, the most strange thing about it is that every game that he has played in, if we score, he will always be in the celebration picture. Does not matter where he is on the pitch, he is in the picture. Even there's even documented proof of him being on the bench and he still finds a way to be in the celebration picture.
He's the Arsenal's Jason Tindall.
He is. He actually is. I'm serious. But that's a little bit, just a funny little tidbit if you ever get bored and look up Arsenal goal celebrations with Cedric Suarez in him, because there's just so many.
He's going to be in the stand. He's going to be in the, you're going to look back at like Thierry Henry breaking the record and he's like in the stand somewhere.
We're getting into, you know, those YouTube videos where it's like, whatever, iceberg explained. It's like Cedric Suarez, iceberg explained.
It's literally, it's a Where's Waldo for Cedric Suarez anytime we score a goal.
The admin's probably just taking the piss and freaking editing him in to every picture. Yeah. Like,
oh my goodness. So my number one is quite a funny one. So we kind of talked about like our first FIFAs back in the day. And, you know, I think my first one was FIFA 15. I don't think I know. It was FIFA 15. And, you know, being a Palace fan, you know, you always play with them when you're playing your friends. And I saw this guy and was like, why does this guy look 50 years old? And it's because he pretty much was at the time. So I've come to know him for being just that random 50-year-old on the bench who I never really got to see play because he didn't play at all. And that is Newcastle legend Shola Amiobi, making only 4 appearances after he signed in the winter of 14-15. Apparently, from what I've heard from other Palace fans who were talking about him, they said that he was just brought on at the end of games to hold onto the ball and secure the win for us. So I know he was great at Newcastle, but that just seems so random to sign him in the winter. And like, maybe he was just like a backup option or something, but that's just funny how he looked ancient to little me back then. So yeah, interesting player for sure. But that's a fun one to talk about. I mean, I literally could have made a top 15 because like I was telling Reese, we've got like Christian Benteke's brother, Jonathan, who signed when he signed back in 2016. We had a bunch of random Chelsea players on loan, like Patrick Bamford, Loic Remy. And then I was telling Reese about this one too, but like Matthew Flamini in 2016.
Oh yeah. What about Marwan Shamak?
Oh yeah. You know, he actually wasn't too bad, but that was also a weird one. That's another weird one. So it seems like Chelsea to Palace and Arsenal to Palace is quite a theme as well back then. So
here's a, well, Reese kind of already answered this, but I'll ask Ethan, like, who's a player at Palace right now that you think in like 10 years we'll be looking back and you'll be like, oh my God, like that's so weird that they were there.
Hold on. I'm going to pull it up just so I can get a visual. What about you?
I don't know. I asked that question and had no idea what I was going to say in terms of Spurs. So no, I'm also clueless, but.
Yeah. Reese had, he was telling me that he had someone in the, in his top five who was still playing for them today. And I was like, man, I should probably have one or two of those, but let's see here. I'm looking at
I'll give you another name for Arsenal that I think, you know, the criteria in 10 years, I kind of think Aaron Ramsdale, because I think he's going to end up moving because he's not playing and he's going to end up being good wherever he goes and stay there a long time. And it'll be 10 years down the road and we'll be like, wow, I can't believe he was an Arsenal player.
He can't be the most, but he played a whole season as starting goalkeeper. Surely that like disqualifies him from being weird.
I feel like in 10 years, we won't remember.
Maybe.
Okay. I have two for you. I've got, you know, it's still early, but I thought it was very random this season, but Rob Holding, he probably, he might not ever make another appearance. And then, I just had him a second ago. Hold on. Where is he? Oh God, it's embarrassing. So embarrassing. Nathan Ferguson.
Oh, the chronically injured man.
Yeah, just because he's never made, he barely has made an appearance and he keeps getting injured. So
I think for Spurs, the big one is probably Jed Spence, because we signed him from Nottingham Forest. He played a few games under Conte and he's just been like shipped around to everyone and their mom on loan, and who knows if he's going to stay after this season, like what's going to happen. The other one on the other side, I think, is Ryan Sessegnon, who's still at the club, by the way. He's still in the squad, and every press conference, like when Ange is giving fitness updates, he's like, yeah, you know, we've got Madison who's got a knock, we've got whoever who's got a knock, and Ryan Sessegnon, who we have no idea when he's going to be back. So he's just like perpetually injured forever. Who knows if he's even going to leave, if he's going to stay at the club, if he's going to ever play again, but yeah, crazy stuff. So, all right, let's move away from the mystery segment and get to the not so mystery segment, which is of course our dissection of the weekend's action with a careful eye over all the events that have occurred. So Ethan, Palace have finally gotten a much-needed win on the board, and it does come at the expense of one of the league's most terrible teams in Burnley, but what are your overall thoughts on Palace's performance? Were you satisfied, or do you chalk this up to the opposition?
So, it's kind of a bit of both. I mean, when you think about it, it's not the kind of performance you want to see, but it's a typical Roy Hodgson performance. And the fact that you invite the pressure on by a team who's not so confident at the moment and expose them when possible. And that's what happened with the first goal when I texted that the terrorist Jeffrey Schlupp has gotten on the score sheet, who is not actually a terrorist, but you know, he feels like one because he keeps getting into the team every week. So, but you know, well-worked play, Jordan Ayew once again being annoying and messing with their defense, who looked a bit fragile this game.
Broke someone's ankle. For that assist.
Yeah, he basically put, I think his name is Beyer.
Yeah, Jordan Beyer
in a spin cycle and, you know, led to a tap in by Schlupp. But other than that, we kind of just invited pressure the rest of the game until the end where Tyrek Mitchell was able to get on the board, which I'm very happy for because, you know, he's been playing well and deserved to get a goal at some point this season. So, Burnley are a weird team at the moment, just because, you know, we thought they would come up to the Premier League inspired by, you know, legend Vincent Kompany at the helm, but, you know, it just hasn't looked too good. And this game was an identifier that they're going to have a really tough season ahead. The one thing I will point out is that they had a really bright spot with Cole Osho on the wing. He was a big problem for Joel Ward, who continues to be our weak spot every game, so that will have to be something we think about, but he looked very good. I think if, you know, he gets more service throughout the season, he could be the main man for them. But
he was good against Spurs too.
Right.
He's been impressive.
Yeah. So very much a Roy Hodgson performance, you know, with Schlupp scoring, we might see him start the rest of the season, even when Olise is back. But this game saw Eze come back, and, you know, he didn't have too much time on the ball. But he did provide an assist for Tyrick Mitchell. So I'm very happy about that. And so hopefully he'll have more to do next game against Everton. And Ahamada looked good as well. And I'm glad he's getting more of a chance because I know he's really talented. So, you know, you can't really be too upset. You know, we got a good result, but it's just the way that these performances are getting us wins is very scary, but it ends up working out. And I think it's the best thing you could do at the moment with, you know, some injuries as well as playing these teams that are around you. Like we have Everton next, and then after the international break, we have Luton Town Town. So I think we're doing good at the moment. Definitely trying to get as many points as we can before December, because I think December is going to be a tough month for us. So yeah, I think it was a decent performance.
We've talked about it before, but we've talked about how it's really great, especially for Palace, to score early, because y'all's best attribute has been, you know, across time, defending and just absorbing pressure and trying to break later on, like you mentioned. But I was thinking, like, what other positives come from that? And I think the main one, especially right now with the way the defense is set up, is that when you score early and you just allow yourself to sit back for practically the whole game and counter, Joel Ward, at the very least, won't get exposed on pace because he will just be next to his goal for the whole game. So it's really huge. Especially, I mean, I already forgot his name, but Burnley's left winger.
Koleosha.
With how good of a game he was having, imagine him, you know, getting in behind Joel Ward and like Joel Ward not already being in position ready to defend. So it definitely could have been a lot worse for sure. The other thing I wanted to know was that Johnston, at least in the beginning of the game, didn't have much to do, but towards the end, man, he is just proving. I mean, we talked about it, I think, when he played for Middlesbrough, right? I'm correct in that.
West Brom.
When West Brom went down, we talked about, you know, Johnston will surely get a Prem move, and it didn't happen until this summer. And I think he's absolutely proving that maybe he should have, because he is very good and very consistent. You know, I transferred him out of my fantasy team once y'all signed Dean Henderson, and then Dean Henderson got injured, so I kind of regret my
decision. Don't get me started on that move.
I mean, Johnston's just been really good.
Right.
And there's your random player, Ethan, for 10 years. You're going to be like, what the hell? We signed Dean Henderson?
Yeah. I mean, he seems like a very Palace player, but in the sense of that, we didn't really need a goalkeeper and we're spending that much money on him. But yeah, I'm glad you brought up Sam Johnston, because he absolutely had a great game and he continues to perform well. And that was the one thing I was worried about when, you know, we were having that drama with Guaita and him wanting a move away, is that would we have a goalkeeper who's able to, you know, kind of keep up with his shot stopping and stuff like that. And Johnston is, I would say, just a little bit better than Guaita so far from what I've seen. I mean, Guaita was a good shot stopper, but so is Sam Johnston, and his distribution is great. And he seems very, like, you know, always, you know, ready to stop something if it needs to happen, because, you know, they had a lot of, you know, shots on target there at the end that were like fizzing into the goal. So, you know, I've been very impressed with him so far. He kind of seems like a Kim's deal in his own way, though, because there was like a shot from outside the box and, you know, it looks like he could save it easily, but, you know, for the cameras. So
what about English goalkeepers? Yeah,
it's like they teach it at the England international
team. Like Pickford is kind of the same way too.
Yeah, kind of. But very weird result, but, you know, that's just a typical Roy Hodgson performance.
After taking a giant flaming dump all over Sheffield United last week, they managed to pick up their first win of the season. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because that now brings them almost exactly level with Burnley. Same exact record. Burnley have a goal difference of -19. Sheffield United have a goal difference of -21. So pretty much the exact same point in the season. So as much as I was dumping on Sheffield United last week, I think you can transfer that to me now being dumping on Burnley because they're practically the same team. I cannot believe I predicted this team to finish 10th, bro.
You know what it is Sheffield at least know what they are, and that is a relegation scrap team. Burnley is trying to pretend like they're going to – or not pretend. I'm sorry. That sounds very aggressive. Burnley's style of play is build up from, their style of play, and it worked in the championship, is build up from the back, very Man City-esque, right? I mean, it's company, worked under Pep for a long time as a player. So, you know, trying to build up from the back, play this tiki-taka possession football, but you just don't have the players for that, especially in the attacking third. I mean, they just do not have enough attacking quality for that kind of play. I feel like they just don't realize what they actually are, and they're trying to play a style that just doesn't suit their players.
And I mean, these players aren't bad, but that's asking so much of Jay Rodriguez to score like 20 goals every season. Like, you can't get that. You might get like 5, but yeah, they're not prepared.
One thing that I would bring up in their defense is that the first time that they got promoted to the Prem back in 14-15, Sean Dyche was manager, and it was pretty clear from the early going that they were going to get relegated, but they stuck with him. They let him take the team down, have another season in the championship, get your parachute payments, build up the squad, that kind of thing. And then he brought the team back up, and they were obviously sustained for another 6 or 7 seasons until they ended up going down. So maybe if there ever was an example of a team sticking with a manager in spite of an impending relegation, it actually was Burnley doing that many years ago. So maybe they'll stick with Vincent Kompany, give him the faith that he needs. Yeah, maybe you get relegated, but you have some cash from the TV revenue to spend next season. Maybe you bring in a few more quality players, dominate the championship again, and then by the time you come back up, maybe you'll have enough quality on the pitch to, you know, make your way in the Premier League to survive at that point. So
yeah,
I'm not really interested in talking about getting rid of Kompany at this point because they're so early on into building his identity. So yeah, that's where I'm at with Burnley, I think.
Yeah. And I agree with that. I feel like whenever you are trying to get like a rebuild in and you've got like a younger manager, you kind of have to stick by him. I know Sean Dyche is a different, you know, example just because he's been a manager for so long and he's always good at grinding out those results, but you know, we'll see because, you know, Kompany had a great time in the championship, but, you know, that's still kind of just recovering from having some Premier League quality players in the championship. And so we'll kind of see, I guess, this season and the next season, how that goes.
All right. Let's abandon that game very swiftly, leave it all behind, and move along to the next fixture on our list, which I guess chronologically would be Man City absolutely demolishing Bournemouth 6-1. And the big story from this game, of course, was Jeremy Doku, who tied a Premier League record for most assists in one game, that being 5. Of course, he had a goal as well, and he could have had another. He had a really good chance up at the very end of the game to make it 7-1, which he didn't take, which would have put him at 6 goal involvements in the game. Now, normally, and I said this to the guys actually when we were talking about which fixtures we were going to discuss, normally we don't talk about City on the pod just because they're not that interesting. Like, analyzing them every single game is practically the same idea. But what I wanted to bring up, which we haven't really talked about, is how some of their new signings have been integrated. And some of them are better than others. Obviously, Doku probably the standout this season. But the two midfield signings who have had to deputize in a big way, which is Kovacic and Mateus Nunez. So I'm interested to see, you know, what you guys make of the Kovacic signing, the Nunez signing. Will they both maintain their place in the team when Rodri comes back, when De Bruyne comes back? What is...
Rodri's back.
He is back. You're so right. And they're both...
He's played in this game.
Yeah. So anyway, what is y'all's take on Kovacic and Nunez? Because I think we were all a little bit befuddled by those signings when they first happened. Yeah. But I don't know. What do y'all think?
I think at the time I was envisioning a midfield trio of Rodri, Kovacic, De Bruyne, which I thought was strange. But now that they're playing Julian Alvarez in more of a cam role, and we know that De Bruyne can play as a center mid and just be really good, in transition. I mean, we saw that they like playing creative players there because Bernardo Silva played there last weekend, and he also plays as a six against us. I actually think when De Bruyne is back, it'll be Rodri, De Bruyne, and Julian Alvarez, in which case Kovacic is the backup, which I think is much more appropriate, and I'm actually completely okay with the signing in that case. If he is intended to be the starter, I still don't really think he's up to snuff, but I think he's a good player. I just think he's not Man City's starting quality. But...
He's not Gundogan, is he?
Yeah, exactly.
Which, you know, it's going to be hard to replace him from that standpoint. And maybe what the plan is for Kovacic to be your guy for a season or two. Obviously, he's aging. He is someone who has, you know, experience winning the Premier League, winning the Champions League. So he's someone you could bring in as a steady presence. But then, you know, you kind of shape Mateus Nunez to turn into the Gundogan replacement in the long term. Maybe that's kind of the idea. They also have had cameos this season from Oscar Bob, who's the Norwegian youth project. He's a project. The youth product. Who is also featured in roles similar to that. Of course, Rico Lewis is technically a midfielder by trade, so they have a lot of options to bring in terms of that possible long-term replacement. And yeah, it's just an interesting one to see. I think Kovacic, it's just so weird still to see him playing for City. It just doesn't quite compute in my head every time I see him out there. So yeah, kind of a bizarre one. I don't know. Do all of you think that City are pretty much guaranteed to win the league this season? I mean, early to write off, but
I don't think so. I think it's really close at the top right now. And obviously Tottenham, after the unfortunate injuries and red cards that we'll get to later, are going to have a little bit of a rough time in the coming weeks.
Yeah.
Obviously Arsenal, two games where we drop points in a row. Yes. Is that true? I'm completely forgetting. No, that's not true. But we've dropped quite a few points to, like, you know, Fulham in the Newcastle game that we'll get to.
Sheffield, Liverpool. Not Sheffield United, Chelsea.
Yeah, Chelsea. Liverpool once again dropping random points to Sheffield of all teams.
Luton. We're all over the place.
I can't speak to Luton of all teams. So, it does look, because City, I think, are about to go on a very long, in typical Man City fashion, just a long unbeaten streak. But I think it'll still stay competitive. I hope it'll still stay competitive. We saw it last year. I think City definitely, I would say, looked better. But last year they had Haaland, who right now, at least recently, has kind of been in a goal drought is extreme, because I think it's like two games. But
score six and him to not be involved in a single one is crazy.
Compared to last season when he's scoring like 50 goals in all competitions or whatever it was. But it still stayed competitive till the end last year. So I think it'll be more competitive this year than it was last year.
Oh, for sure. But it's also worth mentioning that their next couple fixtures, they have Chelsea next away, Liverpool next at home, Spurs at home, and then Aston Villa away, which the way
big games.
A lot of those teams have been playing in recent weeks, maybe the Spurs game will be the easiest of those, actually, depending on who's available. But those are four big games. I mean, those are games that you could see City losing, especially the Liverpool game. So maybe we'll have a more clear picture by the time, you know, the beginning of December rolls around and they've played all those games. We'll have a more clear picture of how things are going to shake down at City. So just an interesting one. Touching on Bournemouth, it's hard to sack a manager after losing to City, even in ridiculous fashion like this. I think you just kind of have to take this one on the nose and move on. However, he is building up a lot of bad credit in the bank, given all the results that have not gone their way this season. They've only got one win, a few draws. I'm not sure what to make of this Bournemouth team. I think we've had this conversation a few times, but how much longer do they give Areola?
What are their next fixtures coming up?
I was just looking that up, actually.
So they've got Newcastle, and then after the international break, Sheffield United, Villa, Palace, United, and then Luton. So it's very sporadic.
That, I think the three games from those would be Sheffield United, maybe Palace, definitely Luton. that they will be looking to get some kind of result. You know, you want to win against your direct rivals, then maybe at Palace they're hoping for a draw. I don't know who's home in that game, but I think if they went no points in those three, maybe even if they lose to Sheffield.
No, I was going to say, I think if you get hammered by Newcastle and then lose to Sheffield United, he's gone.
Yeah, like, right.
The Sheffield one, yeah, that'll probably be the teller.
Because they'll probably lose to Newcastle. I don't think they're going to react. They shouldn't react to a loss to Newcastle because they're just obviously a better team. Maybe some drama there with Eddie Howe and Jason Tindall. Definitely Jason Tindall back at his former club. But yeah, I think you probably accept that you're going to lose to Newcastle. I think a draw at Sheffield United still buys you some time. But then after that, if you lose to Palace and Luton, I mean, you've got to get it together. So yeah, I think that Sheffield United game is a big turning point, honestly. So
yep.
One thing I wanted to ask, has Sinisterra been injured?
Or is I think he just hasn't really been integrated into the team yet. And I think now he finally is starting to get some games. So that could be a difference maker.
A couple games back, I think you posed the question, Gage, who is the guy in their team that is going to score goals for them? I think Sinisterra is the answer. Obviously, it's easy to say after he got a goal in this game. But he's got to get integrated as soon as possible.
And he was only a substitute in this game. So maybe that buys him a start against Newcastle. And then, you know, you hope he just kicks on from there. So
he was a sub in the Burnley-Bournemouth game. And I don't think the Wolves game before that, he wasn't in the team at all. So it looks like he's still like, getting integrated still.
They also do have Tyler Adams, who is kind of dealing with a lingering issue. He still has to come into the team. So that could be a big one as well. A nice addition. Although I wouldn't say the midfield is where they're hurting again. I still just have so many questions about how this team is going to score goals. Maybe Sinisterra will be the answer, but yeah, I mean, even now I'm looking at this team and I'm looking at the bench and I'm thinking, yeah, there's lots of good players you can bring on there. Semenyo, who's impressed me at times this season, Sinisterra, David Brooks, Dongo Ouattara, who we know had a good season at the end of last year. So lots of good names they can bring on. It's just not clicking for them for some reason. So I don't know if it's just the case of too many new players too soon, or is the manager's message not getting through? I know, you know, this is kind of a trivial thing, but I have been reading Areola is not the best English speaker. So in a league of, you know, in a league in England, yeah, you have a lot of players from different nationalities on the team, but generally English is kind of the language that everyone has to operate off of. So if he's not, you know, able to communicate in a language that everyone can understand, you're getting translations. There's lots of steps between him and the players. So yeah, I mean, it's just something to think about. Of course, I've heard Ben Foster actually used to talk about on his podcast that when he played under a manager who couldn't speak English, it just made things so much harder to absorb for the team. So it's obviously that much harder to galvanize everyone when you're having to go through several people to get there. So just something to think about. Obviously there have been plenty of managers in the league beforehand who English was not their first language, but yeah, it is something to think about when you're battling for relegation like they're going to be. So
I did want to drop one more line on Doku. He is what City thought they were getting when they bought Grealish. Just explosive, very tricky.
A 1v1 specialist.
Looking, yeah, 1v1 specialist. Always looking to speed up play, where I think, and I think this is a player Grealish was. I don't really know what happened. Maybe it was coaching. Maybe I find that hard to believe. But he kind of now seems like he's always wanting to slow down play, not really taking on players one-on-one. So I think, this is going to prove to be such a great signing. And I think it's already proved to be a great signing.
Right. And it's funny. I was actually thinking about this earlier. I was kind of comparing him to Zaha, not similarly, but like on how different they are. And I'm only using this because obviously I'm a Palace fan, so it's easy to compare. But Zaha very much was like this when he was younger. But as he got older, he kind of slowed down and started, you know, taking on these defenders and trying to get around them slowly. But Doku is just so explosive on the ball. You know, every involvement from the highlights, he was just, you know, running fast and stuff like that. So, and like you said, it's very different from Grealish. So I think that's kind of something that they've been looking to go along with their other players like Foden, like Alvarez, and especially Haaland, who, even though didn't score, is probably the one of the most explosive players in the league.
Let's move on now to what I would call an explosive atmosphere at Newcastle, an explosive aftermath too, for sure. Lots of question marks in this game. Of course, the biggest one, probably the refereeing. My biggest question mark is why is Mikel Arteta such a twat? But moving on from that, I'll pass it off to Reese, of course, who I'm not sure where you want to start in this game. I don't know if you want to start with the performance.
I'll start with why Arteta is such a twat. I'm kind of starting with that. I'm starting with the referees because it's kind of combined. I have some notes written down, but the main thing is the referees. I was so mad after this game. It's not uncommon for me to be mad at the referees. It's something I do quite a lot, but this goes back to Liverpool-Tottenham. Not in the decision or whatever, but with Klopp and what I said about it. At the time, I said, you know, calling for a replay, it's not going to happen. It's outlandish. But I am completely okay with statements you want to make, with the club backing you up. Just I make as much noise as possible and be as critical of the referees as possible. I don't understand, because now we're getting to this point where Arteta goes after the game and says this is unacceptable, and then the club has to back him up because, you know, he's about to get fined. So I don't understand the all at once outrage from opposition fans and from, you know, Sky Sports pundits and, you know, your Jamie Carragher's and you know, everyone involved. I think I referenced them as the clown squad earlier today before we started the podcast.
You did.
Because I don't know what's bad about criticizing a referee when they do a bad job, because that is their job. And they're doing it poorly, and the standards have to be higher. What it seems like, and because United played today, and of course, they had decisions go against them, and I haven't looked at them, but from what I can tell, they were the wrong decisions. And some of the personalities that were saying Arteta should not speak bad about the refs immediately went and said the refereeing disgraceful. This is terrible performance. So it just seems like everyone wants to only talk about it when it's their own team. But the only way the refereeing standards will change in any meaningful capacity is if you take off your rival fan sunglasses and say, yeah, you know what, the refereeing was terrible and they should try and fix it. That's my soapbox. The refereeing was awful. I will talk about the goal, because there was three separate VAR incidents that they looked at. One, the ball being potentially out of play. Two, a potential foul on Gabriel. Three, potential offsides. I thought the ball was out of play. I understand the camera angles. That's not even the one I'm mad at. I also understand camera angles with offside. I think he was probably onside, so I'm actually okay with that as well. I think this is the clearest foul of all time. I don't understand how this was not given a foul. And then, you know, we have a Champions League game today. Napoli, I can't remember whose goal it was, whether it was for Napoli, whoever they were playing. But the exact same thing happened today in the Champions League. The goal was disallowed for a foul. I just don't understand. I don't understand how it happens. The other incident is, of course, Bruno Guimarães somehow on the pitch when the game ends, had probably five separate instances where he should have received a yellow card and did not receive any kind of card. Had one instance where he definitely should have received a red, did not receive a card at all. And I mean, that just changes the whole game. It completely changes the game. So anyway, it infuriates me. The game infuriates me. I did read today that some manager union is drafting up a list of proposals in the wake of Arteta's statements to improve VAR. And I think that's a good step. I think you have to get a group of people that say, yeah, this is bad. Let me list some ideas on maybe how we can improve it. Those ideas included, in which is something I've talked about, the simplification in more detailed understanding of what clear and obvious means, because that just completely gives them a scapegoat in every scenario, because they can say, well, it's not clear and obvious.
Do they even reference that? Is that even a stipulation in the rules anymore? Like, I feel like they just do whatever they want. I feel like they don't.
That's what I'm saying. They do whatever they want. And then if they get in trouble, they can say, well, clear and obvious, blah, blah, blah. Sure, I guess. So, yeah, that was all my refereeing annoyances. Moving on to the game. Not that I got that out. Unless you all have things to say about the refs.
No, I don't actually. I'm relatively fine with what Arteta said. I just don't really like him from a personal level. He just kind of rubs me the wrong way, which could be because I'm a Spurs fan, but he's just kind of a weirdo, which, trust me, Spurs have had some weirdos managing us in the last couple of years too, so I get it. But he just kind of rubs me the wrong way. But, of course, that is probably because I'm a Spurs fan. I lost my train of thought now. I'm actually pretty okay with what he said as far as the referees. I'm starting to agree with you in terms of, like, if nothing gets said, nothing's going to be done, because, like, they've issued all these apologies at the start of the season. We're 11 games in, and it seems to only be getting worse.
Which, you know, what is the real indicator of how they view their punishments and how they need to fix things is that Anthony Taylor is going to be refereeing the Chelsea game this weekend. He's already back. So,
yeah, Chelsea fans, I'm sure, are going to be livid about that because they think he has a grand conspiracy to end all things Chelsea. Here's where I'm at with VAR. And we're going to come on to this a little bit, not a little bit, a lot, in the Spurs-Chelsea game, because I think even when they're getting decisions correct, it is such a detriment to the experience. Like, it has reached the point where it is almost no longer enjoyable to watch games because everything that happens is being looked over with a fine-tooth comb by some dick in front of a video screen in Stockley Park. So I'm almost to the point where I think we should just scrap it, live with the wrong decisions, bring in the semi-automated offside tool, and be done with it. I think that's honestly where I'm at with VAR. I think it fixes a lot of the refereeing errors. Yeah, we're going to get mistakes, but at least now it's, oh, well, the referee, like, the linesman couldn't keep up with the play, or the referee just missed it, or, you know, actual things that can be explained by human error, whereas these guys who are looking at the video, there's no explanation for why they're getting this stuff wrong, right? So
I think part of it is referees now are intentionally not calling things because they know VAR will look at it. And then VAR will find some way to say, well, in this specific scenario, you could see the ref not calling it in this way.
It's turned into a political entity.
Yeah, they're like, so it's not clear and obvious, I can't overturn them, even though the reason they didn't call it was because VAR was going to look at it in the first place.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's absolute insanity. That's all I have on the referees for now.
I mean, we literally, Reese and I were watching Champions League today, and in the Galatasaray-Bayern game, Galatasaray scored, and it was offside, and they had automatic view or automatic offside. So it was, they got playing immediately. Yeah. It's like, it takes so long just to, you know, do these things. And they're like, well, is it clear and obvious? Draw the lines here or there. It's,
yeah,
it takes too much time. They're like, oh, we can't let it take too much time, but it does. This just does. And so it's frustrating to see how terrible England is with VAR and how like successful it is in other leagues and whatnot.
Yeah, that was a big talking point after the Spurs-Chelsea game, that the VAR got the right decisions, but just took too long.
Here, can I give a stat? I was going to give this stat earlier, but since we're doing the referees now, I'm going to give it now. In the Spurs-Chelsea game in the first half, there were 9 VAR checks. There were 23 minutes where the ball was in play. There were 28 minutes where a VAR check was ongoing. How does that happen? How are we are the fans in the ground are paying money to watch the officials get stuff like, it's just,
I'm going full conspiracy mode. I think they did this on purpose. I think Arteta badmouthed them and they said, okay, we're going to VAR check everything and we're going to take 8 years. So now everyone hates VAR. The thing is like, because now the talking point is that it takes too long. But like the reality is, like we said, a lot of the time wasted is from offsides. Implement semi-auto tech, all of that's pretty much solved. So I don't know. We have
I don't know. They spent freaking they spent like 5 or 6 minutes on the Christian Romero red card decision too. Yeah. So,
and I can almost guarantee the reason they spent so long is because of the clear and obvious rule. They're trying to decide whether or not the ref could have.
They're just sitting around humming and hawing.
Can be justified and whatever. I don't know.
The technology also just sucks. Like if they were looking so long at the ball going out of play, then why was there only one camera angle? Like that.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah. Like, come on. Like if
I don't understand. I mean, this would be a big initiative, I think, but we have goal line tech for the goals. Like, surely there is some kind of tech we could implement to see if the ball has gone out of play.
They have it in tennis. They literally have it in tennis. It's like, it's an immediate call. Was the ball in or was the ball out? Easy. Like, it. So the technology exists out there.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, it's crazy.
And, you know, I'm not even going to spend too long on it because it's ridiculous. But when they had that one call where there was just a big discommunication between the guy on the field and then the room.
The Liverpool
like,
one.
Oh my God. Just thinking about that, it grinds my gears just because of how like brain dead that was. So yeah, we talk about it every week, but it's just so ridiculous to the point that we need it to change so bad, but it's just not going to. And we're going to keep dealing with this bullshit.
The crazy thing is we didn't even used to talk about it every week. Like we would talk about it every other week or maybe once a month, there would be a refereeing decision that's like so bad that we have to talk about it. It's every single week. Like I think you could go back and find every episode of ours apart from the season preview where we're discussing something that the referees have gotten wrong. It's nuts. It's every week and it's almost every game. Yeah. So I don't even know what you do to fix it. I mean, you almost just have to sack them all and get a whole new group in. Bring in some freaking independent like committee from some other league. I don't know, dude. I don't even know what the solution is.
Yeah. I will speed through my thoughts on the game. I don't have too many, and I used my time on the refs, which I think is important. But first thing, obviously still no Odegaard out injured. I thought Havertz looked okay at CAM. I still kind of waiting on him to develop in this midfield role. I don't know how much time I'm gonna give him right now. I think maybe some more, but I said that a few weeks back too. Thought he looked okay. Along the lines of Havertz, I think Newcastle fans are calling for a red on his tackle. I think the referees did get this one spot on, which is funny to say because it goes in our favor. But they spoke about their justification, and I think the justification makes sense. And it's that if you look, obviously, if he connects with his outstretched leg, it's a red card, no question. But he connects with his trailing leg, what they deemed was reckless, not dangerous, because of the nature that the tackle went in, which I think makes sense. Ends up being a yellow. Declan Rice playing at the 8 role in this game and then later dropping to 6. I am just continually impressed with him. He is a monster. Moving on. I have no more thoughts. He's way too good. The game itself was very physical. I think that's to be expected. The commentators talked about this, which I think is it is important to note that, you know, there was this stigma, not really since in the past few years, but a while back, there was this continued idea that Arsenal are very bullyable. Like we can just very easily be bullied in these types of games. And I think away at St. James, we did a really good job at not only taking some of this physicality from Newcastle, but returning it and really battling it out. And I think that's thanks to players like Declan Rice, players like Gabriel, who his battle with Wilson is just really, it happens every time we play them. Really fun to watch. They're always, you know, grabbing at each other, you know, tripping over each other, that kind of stuff, but nothing ever gets called because they're both doing it. And it's definitely fun to watch, in that aspect. So that's all I have. We can move on now.
Well, it's a decent segue because we were talking about it when we talked about the referees, but I'll move on now to the Spurs-Chelsea game, which I'm not even really sure where to start with this game, so I'll just say this. I think God must have been on vacation for the first 10 games of the season because he came back and saw that Spurs were playing well and, you know, things were happening at Tottenham and people were happy and enjoying the team and decided to take all of our bad luck out for the season on us in one game.
He smited y'all.
Yeah, I actually wrote that in my notes. I said, God has forgotten to smite Spurs up until this point. So yeah, a crazy thing. And then my next thing is, how many storylines do you want in one game of football? Could it be Pochettino returning for the first time to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium? Could it be two players for Spurs losing their heads and getting stupid red cards when they easily could have been sent off two different times throughout the course of the game? Could it be the fact that there were 23 minutes of play in the first half and 28 minutes of officiating? Could it be that there were five, count them, five disallowed goals across both teams? Could it be that Van de Ven and Madison are both injured following this game, arguably two of our most crucial performers in the season? Could it be that Richarlison has now decided that this is the time that he is going to get major hip surgery and be out for long periods of time? Could it be that nine men were playing a 7-1-0 at the halfway line?
Yeah, that's hilarious.
That was
could
crazy.
It be that Vicario had one of the greatest goalkeeping performances in Premier League history and still conceded four goals? Could it be that Chelsea's attack has no idea how to score a goal? Zero idea how to score. Could it be that Nico Jackson is a giant twat because he scored two goals after in attacking time in extra time against a team with nine who were playing at the halfway line and decided to do the Ronaldo celebration?
You know what's hilarious is he scored a hat trick and he underperformed his XG.
Yeah, it's only him, and he had two goals disallowed for being offside against nine men. That's crazy.
One of the worst hat tricks of all time.
Could it be that Eric Dier and Pierre-Emile Højbjerg played center back for Tottenham Hotspur Football Club in the year of our Lord 2023 and actually played pretty well? Like, I don't know which of those storylines you guys are fancying at this time, but which one sticks out the most to you out of the 40 that I've just read off, other than the referees? Don't take that one. But
I mean, I don't know, but if headlines were food, then Premier League is a fat bastard, because that is so many headlines.
I have some notes written down about the high line with 10 men, because I had questions for you. With nine men, excuse me. This to me just looks like bad defending. Like, it could have been 10 if Chelsea had a square. Now, my first thought was, what is happening? Like, why is this happening? But then I thought about it, because I understand that Postecoglou is not stupid. So I was like, what could he possibly gain out of sticking with this? Do you think maybe the reason he did this was to basically decide, you know, the game's done, we're going to lose, let me test out, let me play the most high line imaginable and test whether or not Eric Dier is going to be able to cope in any capacity?
No, I actually think part of that is true. Like, I seriously think once you go down to nine, even at 1-1, your chances of winning the game are less than 5%. Like, maybe less than 1%. I mean, the idea that you could possibly win and then fend off all of the attacks coming in with nine men is pretty asinine. I think there are a couple reasons for that. I think he probably was aware of the fact that Chelsea cannot score. I think against a different opponent, maybe it's a slightly different. I mean, against Man City, if you do that, they're going to score 20. Like, legitimately, they're going to score 20. So I think the fact that it's Chelsea and he knows they have confidence issues in attack, maybe that has something to do with it. I think he learned a ton more about the players that finished the game this way than he would have if we sat nine behind the ball. I think he learned a lot more about Eric Dier, a lot more about Pierre-Emile Højbjerg, about Bentancur, Skip, Vicario. I think he learned so much about all of these guys and what kind of heart they're willing to give to the team, even with nine men. You know, Højbjerg made a block on the line in the 60th minute and, like, went apeshit. It was down to nine men, and he's, like, beating his chest and going silverback gorilla mode. Like, just because he blocked this clearance off the line and I think some part of that team actually thrived on being down to nine. Like, it almost strengthened the bonds of fellowship or whatever between the team, because they were in such a shitty situation together. And I think also we learned quite a bit about the fans. I think, you know, Arsenal had that moment where I referenced this a lot, actually, where Saliba scored an own goal. And the crowd immediately starts cheering and going insane and giving him an ovation and singing his song, right? This is kind of our version of that, because Nico Jackson scores his fourth to make his hat trick. Spurs are down to nine. What a terrible, terrible thing to have happened. And the crowd immediately stands up and has a standing ovation, goes insane, like serenades the players and like commends their efforts and all this stuff. And I think it just shows that like the identity of the club is back. And honestly, I've had so much of watching Spurs sit behind the ball in the last 5 years that I'm okay with this. Like, I'm almost okay with us just saying, fuck it, let's see. And Son was through in the last minute before the third goal went in. Son was through and almost had a chance to equalize. And if the Eric Dier thing maybe pans out slightly differently, we have a 2-2 game. You know, Bentancur had a chance in the 86th minute and he just headed wide. So the crazy thing is that Spurs were still creating chances after all that, which maybe is due to the fact that Chelsea are just a heaping pile of shit, to be completely honest with you. But it almost paid off. And yeah. I think that's, and they, he learned a shitload about his team. And I think morale in the camp is going to be high because of what happened afterwards, as it maybe wouldn't have been if the nine men were sitting behind the ball.
Yeah. So, I mean, I won't say that you would have wanted this to happen because you don't want to lose 4-1 to Chelsea when you're top of the league. Now, back in second place, City overtaking. But you, like you mentioned, you're losing pretty badly. The fans are rallying behind the team. That's huge for morale because now they don't have to worry. I mean, I think it was already shown through the course of this season. But like you mentioned with Arsenal, it's very similar. You have to, the players now know we can make mistakes and we're not going to get absolutely crucified by the fans.
Right.
So that helps with confidence, for one. Two, Eric Dier and everyone, but Eric Dier, who's now going to have to deputize at center back in a high line, which we had questions about. Højbjerg, who will be potentially playing as a center back partner. Well, I think he's the only available player in that position. Is Davinson Sanchez? He's not even at the club anymore.
No, he's been sold to Galatasaray. No,
so unless you want to play a youth player, I think.
Theoretically, Ashley Phillips would be next in line, or Ben Davis, who was injured, might play on the left. But it, I think, given what we saw today, there's no reason not to play, Monday. There's no reason not to play Dyer Højbjerg.
But yeah, I mean, you stick them in the most extreme scenario possible. You say, not only are you down to nine men, I'm going to have you defend from your goal, or from the opposition goal. It's kind of like the idea of like, well, you've already done the hardest thing, so now it's all downhill from here, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think ideally, you only have to survive this for three games because Christian Romero comes back after his ban is served. The trouble is, of course, the thing that makes the high line work as well as it does is the other guy who looks to have torn his hamstring. The scans haven't come back or anything. I did see a picture of him at the training ground today, so he was taking part in something. It was probably just recovery, but you never know. They obviously haven't come back with a result about how long he's going to be out for or anything like that. I actually think Madison might only be out for a couple weeks because he's been dealing with a knock this entire season. He practically hasn't trained at all. And he's just been coming on in game situations, like playing 60 minutes, 65 minutes. So he's been dealing with this the entire season. And I think it's just kind of due that maybe he needs to take a couple weeks off. He probably will miss the Wolves game, not go to England in the international break, and then probably will be back for the game after that, which I cannot remember what it is at this exact time. I think it's Liverpool. Villa. Oh, no, we already played.
Oh, you already played Liverpool.
I think it's Villa. I think it's Villa.
I'll double check. Yeah.
The other storyline, I think, is Bentancur coming back into the team and getting 50 minutes, I think, including added time, which I think is huge. Maybe he'll have to start in place of Madison because I'm not sure where Lo Celso's at fitness-wise. Yeah, I can't really remember what all I've talked about and what I haven't, but I think overall, I'm not going to say I'm pleased with the performance. I think the crazy thing about this is that if that Sun goal in the first half, if he's like 3 millimeters further back and scores to make it 2-0, none of this happens. Like Spurs probably go up 3-0 by the break. Game's over. Spurs are top of the league. Everyone's happy, right? And none of this stuff happens. But Instead, that goal gets disallowed. A couple things happen. Romero starts to lose his head, puts in a silly tackle, foots it cleats someone. I can't remember who it was, but
I think they said this is his 7th career red card. Is that true?
Probably. I know it's his 3rd since he's been at Spurs, because he got sent off in Conte's first game at the club in a random Mickey Mouse game, and then got sent off against Man City when we won last season. So yeah, I believe that it's his 7th career red card. Up to this point, though, he's actually shown a bit of maturity. I think this is the first time we've seen him lose his head. It's unfortunate that it just has to come at such a crucial time and in such a big way. I will say Chelsea also should have had a red card with Reece James elbowing Udogie in the head. You can argue whether argue whether he should have been on the pitch at that time anyway, because he two-footed someone, but Chelsea should have been down to 10 as well. So how does that change the game? I don't know. They probably still win because, yeah, the Spurs still probably go down to 9 in that situation. But just something to think about. To conclude, I'm less worried about the center back pairing than I probably would have been going forward. I probably think it's not super feasible for Spurs to keep winning games until 2 of the 3 missing men in Romero, Van de Ven, and Madison. Injuries. Right, until 2 of the 3 return. I think you have to have at least 2 of them back before you can comfortably say we can start winning games again. Wolves will be an interesting test because they're playing really well, and Neto is someone who can exploit the high line. So Wolves will be an interesting test. Villa, I think, will probably lose that game, to be honest. And then after that, we have City. So that'll be...
easy win.
Yeah, easy. Well, it's not at the Spurs stadium, unfortunately. So... yeah, that one could be a big defeat, but we'll see.
I had a feeling that once y'all dropped points, it would kind of have a snowball effect, but I thought it would be slow. I did not expect God to smite you and for everything possible to go wrong in the same game. So that is very unfortunate. And I do want to say, I actually, even if we are rivals, supporting rival clubs, I know exactly how it feels to be top of the league and then to lose your best center back.
Yeah.
So I am sorry. That's
actually both of them. How about that?
Yeah, it's not ideal in any capacity, and it sucks.
Yeah, and I just don't understand, like, why couldn't we just beat Chelsea and then all of this dog shit happens against Wolves? Like, why does it always have to be against Chelsea? I don't understand that.
Because it was Poch.
So... but this has happened to us for years and years. I mean, the Battle of the Bridge was against them too, and like the games at Wembley, and it's just so disgusting, just so stupid. So anyway, all right, enough of that. I don't know if anyone has any final thoughts on the league this weekend, any final actions that they'd like to discuss.
Sheffield United got their first win.
They did, yeah. And poor Fabio Silva crying as he leaves the pitch because he gave away the penalty in the last minute. So yeah, shame for him, but Sheffield United up and running, if you can say that.
They stood up.
Yeah. So okay, let's move into our final sections of the show, and today it will only be the album of the week once again, but I'm going to pass it over to Ethan for that.
Yes sir. So we're getting closer to fall, feeling more like fall. That is the sign that for Ethan to start listening to folk music again. I started listening to this album again, and I think, you know, after thinking about it, it's probably my favorite folk record. But we've got Jim Croce, one of the most iconic folk singers. You Don't Mess Around with Jim, first album. I've always enjoyed this record just because it's a good mix of fun and like a lot of heartfelt lyrics. Jim Croce was a great songwriter. Unfortunately passed away very young in a plane crash, but a lot of his songs have been a comfort to me over the years, just because they, you know, music does a great job of confirming the feelings you might have, and they explain them better than you probably could. So yep, it's one of my favorites, probably my favorite folk artist. But yep,
only song I know off that album is Time in a Bottle, but I really enjoy that song. So
yeah, Time in a Bottle is, I think, the first song I ever heard from him. Operator is one of his most iconic. I recommend that, at least if you're not going to listen to the whole thing. But yeah, he's a great songwriter.
Okay, gentlemen, it's that time where I say thank you for coming on. So, Reese, thanks for coming along.
Of course, thank you for hosting once again.
Ethan as well, thanks for deputizing in many ways for Josh and fulfilling your own role. Thank you.
You got it. Thank you for hosting. I love doing the podcast as much as the rest of y'all, but after talking about wings, I've been tweaking this whole time. Like, I've been tapping my foot just because I haven't had any food today. So, yeah, look forward to the next podcast and look forward to hopefully having Josh back soon.
Absolutely. And a big thanks to you, the listener, for sticking around. We hope you're enjoying the Premier League. We hope you're staying safe, staying healthy. And it's a goodbye from us.